Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, you can join Father Jason Jones of the Menevia Diocese in South Wales, who tells the story of the Welsh National Marian Shrine, known as Our Lady of the Taper, but I won't give too much away, so stay tuned. Meanwhile, as always at this time of week, we begin with Jill Bevilacqua's There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. And it begins with Sean Patrick Lovett reading the Gospel for this fourth Sunday of Easter.
Jesus said, "Truly I assure you, whoever does not enter the sheepfold through the gate, but climbs in some other way, is a thief and a marauder. The one who enters through the gate is shepherd of the sheep. The keeper opens the gate for him. The sheep hear his voice as he calls his own by name and leads them out. When he has brought out all those that are his, he walks in front of them, and the sheep follow him because they recognize his voice. They will not follow a stranger. Such a one they will flee because they do not recognize a stranger's voice." Even though Jesus used this figure with them, they did not grasp what he was trying to tell them. He therefore said to them again, "My solemn word is this: I am the sheep gate. All who come before me were thieves and marauders, whom the sheep did not heed. I am the gate. Whoever enters through me will be safe. He will go in and out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal and slaughter and destroy. I came that they might have life and have it to the full."
There's probably no image in the Gospels more beloved than that of the Good Shepherd. Innumerable are the artists who have represented him. Innumerable the occasions when one or other of the musical versions of David's psalm have been played and sung for church occasions, particularly funerals. "Oh, not the 23rd psalm, please," sighed one parish priest in exasperation. Understandably, but he could not refuse. There's something inherently comforting in the biblical image. And though the readings are different for the three-year cycle, the Gospels for the fourth Sunday of Easter are all taken from the same chapter of John, and the day is generally known as Good Shepherd Sunday. The idea of God as the Shepherd of Israel appears constantly in the Old Testament, writes a modern commentator. But, he goes on, it was never worked out so fully as here. For those listening to our Lord, the reference to sheep and shepherds were very familiar. But even for a 20th century traveller in the Holy Land, it would not have been surprising. H.V. Morton was there in the 1930s.
"On the roads of Palestine and on the hills, you see the Good Shepherd. He comes along at the head of his flock, generally carrying over his shoulders a lamb or an injured sheep. No animal mentioned in the Bible can compare in symbolical interest with the sheep. I believe it's mentioned over 500 times. As you cannot go very far along the roads in Palestine without encountering the figure who, staff in hand, symbolizes the love and compassion of Jesus Christ."
The Greek word aule, or enclosure, originally meant the vestibule or porch of a temple. In the agricultural world, it means the space defined by a dry stone wall covered with thorns or branches. In our Lord's time, this enclosure was common to the whole village. At night, the various shepherds would bring their flocks to the fold, which was guarded by a custodian or keeper. At dawn, the shepherds returned, and the keeper opened the gate for each one, whom he knew, as also the sheep, who, as the Gospel says, hear his voice as he calls his own by name and leads them out. This is another detail which might be foreign to us. As the Gospel has it, when he has brought out all that are his, he walks in front of them, and the sheep follow him, because they recognise his voice. H.V. Morton commented on this pastoral custom and the rapport between the shepherd and his flock.
He never drives them as our own shepherds drive their sheep. He always walks at their head, leading them along the roads and over the hills to new pastures. Our principle of droving is something that neither Arab shepherds nor their sheepdogs understand. It's all done by word of mouth, and the sheep follow their shepherds like dogs. The Arab sheepdog is used, therefore, not to drive sheep, but to protect them against thieves and wild animals.
Not for these sheep, then, the tragic destiny of the newborn lamb in this poem by Ian Sorelia entitled The Fox.
First lambs have come, late snowfall to the hill. All day he watches, feeding on greed till stars in the April sky, he steals shadowy down the valley side. Furtive wades marsh myrtle, and by screen of heather comes where flocks graze. Trembling for quarry, he scans each plucking lamb, chooses, pauses strong as a spell, then flashes to revelry. The lambless ewe sputters down the slope, home over bristly ridge, in one sweep he covers the gliders, then deviously to his deep mountain den, safe down crevice drop, where no terrier dares. On his morning round, death in wool embers is the shepherd's find.
Another peculiarity of the Palestine shepherd was noted by H.V. Morton, and that was the way he communicated with his animals.
As he goes, he sometimes talks to them in a loud sing-song voice, using a weird language unlike anything I've ever heard in my life. I was on the hills at the back of Jericho. It was uncanny because there was nothing human about it. The words were animal sounds arranged in a kind of order. No sooner had he spoken than an answering bleat shivered over the herd.
Whenever I think of an Old Testament prophet, the image that presents itself is invariably that of a wild-looking, primitive creature, bearded, emaciated, and generally rather daunting. As for Ezekiel, even his name sounds gaunt, and with his valley of dry bones, well, and yet in a rather splendid book I have with brilliant modern illustrations, there he is, bearded, yes, with thick eyebrows and great dark eyes and skin that looks like parchment. But what is he holding under his blue cloak? A lamb, no less. For there, among the exiles in Babylon, on the banks of the river Chebar, God spoke to Ezekiel and ordered him to prophesy against the shepherds of Israel who have neglected their flocks.
Shepherds, the Lord Yahweh says this, shepherds ought to feed their flock, yet you have fed on milk. You have dressed yourselves in wool, you have sacrificed the fattest sheep, but failed to feed the flock. You have failed to make weak sheep strong, or to care for the sick ones, or bandage the wounded ones, bring back strays, or look for the lost. For lack of a shepherd they have scattered to become the prey of any wild animal. My flock is straying this way and that, on mountains and on high hills, scattered all over the country. No one bothers about them and no one looks for them. Well then, shepherds, hear the word of Yahweh. Since my shepherds have stopped bothering about my flock, since my shepherds feed themselves rather than my flock, I am going to take my flock back from them. I am going to look after my flock myself and keep all of it in view. As a shepherd keeps all his flock in view when he stands up in the middle of his scattered sheep, so shall I keep my sheep in view. I shall rescue them from wherever they have been scattered during the mist and darkness. I shall feed them in good pasturage. I myself will pasture my sheep. I myself will show them where to rest. It is the Lord Yahweh who speaks. I shall look for the lost one, bring back the stray, bandage the wounded, and make the weak strong. I shall watch over the fat and healthy. I shall be a true shepherd to them.
And so it is Ezekiel who announces the promise of the Good Shepherd, whom God will send to Israel. And it is this prophecy, writes a modern scholar, which seems to dominate our Lord's thought in this parable. Not only does Jesus tell his listeners that he is the Good Shepherd, but he is also the gate of the sheepfold. In biblical tradition, we're told, the gate symbolized access to heavenly realities. When Jacob woke from his dream of the ladder between earth and heaven, he declared, "Surely the Lord is in this place. This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven." These words of Jacob are used in the liturgy of the dedication of a church, while Ezekiel's prophecy is linked to the Jewish feast of Hanukkah, Festival of Lights, which commemorates the rededication of the temple after its profanation by the Syrians. Probably more familiar to most of us than Ezekiel is Isaiah and his prophecy of the Messiah.
He shall feed his flock like a shepherd. He shall gather the lambs with his arm and carry them in his bosom, and shall gently lead those that are with young.
In the very last chapter of John's Gospel, Jesus passes on to Peter the charge of his flock when he says to him, "Feed my lambs and feed my sheep." Pope John the 23rd was especially conscious of this charge given to every pope.
The task of shepherd of the whole flock is very dear to my heart. Other human qualities, knowledge, diplomatic tact, organizational gifts, may embellish and add to pontifical government, but they can in no way substitute it. The shepherd's way, the pastor's way, is this: to count his sheep one by one.
And to close, let's listen to part of this atmospheric poem by Rose Macaulay, entitled simply, Driving Sheep.
The green east flows with the tides of the rose between the bars of night, half-drawn. The moon shines cold and faint on the fold where sheep glimmer, grey in the dawn. All thin like a dream their sad cries seem, caught high above time and space, and old as the world, from out fleece dew-pearled, gazes each meek sheep face. Dazed with sleep and numb, the sheep women come and open the field gate wide. The sheep surge out in an idiot rout, like grey foam swept on a tide. Keep steady, move slow, we've 3 miles to go to Grantchester from Chalkfield Pen. Herd them up all the way, lest some go astray, of our imbecile 20 and 10. unreasoning, blind, each poor unhinged mind takes its thought from the sheep next ahead. Through each hedge gate, if you reach it too late, they charge, wild and pale, like the dead. Their lilting bleat, their sharp, scuttling feet are strange, strange as dreams before day, and counting the sheep, we sway into sleep and trail along, foolish as they.
Warm thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua for this edition of There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. She'll be back again at this same time next week with more readings and reflections for the fifth Sunday of Easter. Meanwhile, I'm about to bring you an interview with Father Jason Jones, who's a priest of the Diocese of Menevia in southwest Wales. He shares with me the story of a Welsh shrine and tells me all about Welsh flowers at the same time, how they're connected to the gospel and also to the coat of arms of Pope Francis. Stay tuned. Father, I heard that you have a special shrine in Wales, don't you?
We do indeed. The shrine is Our Lady of the Taper, Our Lady of Cardigan, which is the Welsh national shrine, designated as such by St. John Paul II in 1986. The shrine goes back to the 12th century.
The story of the shrine is a curious one. No, it's connected to a shipwreck, and it seems that on this occasion, the statue of Our Lady washed up on the shores of Cardigan Bay in West Wales.
The statue was from Flanders originally, and the church was built, and then subsequently, the shrine was looked after by the Benedictines from Chertsey Abbey in England. And eventually the shrine became very, very popular. And then at the Reformation, it was all destroyed, sadly. And then in 1904, some other Benedictines from France were exiled from Brittany and set up a parish in Cardigan and started to restore the shrine until eventually the numbers of pilgrims had increased and the new church and the new shrine had to be built in 1970. And eventually, in 1986, John Paul II made it the National Shrine for Wales, and I was the rector of the shrine for 8 years, and during the visit of Pope Benedict to Great Britain, we took the statue from the shrine up to London, where the Holy Father gave a special blessing to the people of Wales and made a message to the people of Wales, as at that particular time he was unable to come to Wales himself.
The name of the shrine, known also as Our Lady of Taper, as you said a moment ago, is connected to this statue, is it not?
And the statue is one of Our Lady seated with the Christ child, and in the other hand she has a candle.
Or taper.
A very ancient description and portrayal of Our Lady, linked with other shrines, especially the one of our present Holy Father in Buenos Aires, Our Lady with a candle, and also in Sardinia, there are these shrines to Our Lady with a candle, symbolising Christ, the light of the world, and many of the sailors would have had this particular statue of Our Lady with the candle and the Christ child as a reminder to them of the stormy waters of life and the darkness and the light of Christ being a safe haven and a guide for the traveller. And so there are a number of ports which have a similar statue of this image of Our Lady.
The statue, you said, was the result of a shipwreck.
Indeed.
So it arrived in a safe
yes,
haven.
Indeed, yes.
It's an amazing story.
A very, very interesting story, and how in that particular part of West Wales, which is a very Welsh-speaking area, the locals were so devoted to Our Lady that two particular things can be noted. One is that in Wales, no girl was named after Our Lady out of respect for Our Lady. And so in Welsh language, the name Mary is Mair. And no girl was named Mair because of the great love and devotion. And then also to show the faith of and the faith of the people in Our Lady, many, many flowers in the countryside were named after Our Lady in the Welsh language to show the ancient faith of the people and their devotion to Our Lady from the medieval period. There's over 50 flowers in the Welsh Encyclopedia, Botanical Encyclopedia, which portray flowers from Wales, which are named after Our Lady in the Welsh language.
And they are? Is there the rose among them?
There's a selection of them. One of them is Rosyn Mair, which in English would be rosemary, with the blue flower. There's also Chwys Mair, Mary's sweat, which in fact is the buttercup. There's Briallu Mair, Mary's primrose, the cowslip. Menig Mair is Mary's glove, commonly known in English as the foxglove. Dagrau Fair, the fuchsia, Mary's tears in English, and also Tapir Mair, which is a very, very nice flower, found usually on scrub land. Very, very tall flower from the Verbiscum family, and is a large leafy flower, but at the very, very top is a little cluster of yellow flowers symbolising a little candle. And so that's a particular flower of the shrine. Mair Tapir, Our Lady of the Taper, Our Lady of Cardigan. And so this particular flower is often used and found in that particular area of West Wales, in some of the scrubland and in the rocks and on the beach and the coast. Very, very tall flower, up to 2 foot, with this little cluster of yellow as a little light at the top of the flower. Very, very large leaves. That's one of the flowers that we've used often in the shrine. And when Pope Benedict came to Britain, we had a special box commissioned, which was made out of pewter by a local Welsh artist, and she was able to impress into the pewter a number of these flowers to encase a special candle that Pope Benedict lit at Westminster Cathedral, with the fuchsia, Dagrau Mair, Mary's tears, and Briallu Mair, and also Menig Mair, the foxglove. Mantell Mair, Mary's mantle, lady's mantle, often referred to in English, and so that this tradition of the flowers could then be incorporated into this pewter box as a lasting memorial of the visit of Pope Benedict and his lighting of the candle and the leading of the special shrine prayer, which is prayed often at the shrine by the pilgrims, and then every week before the main Sunday Mass, when all the intentions of the pilgrims are remembered and read out as the candle is lit at the start of the Sunday Mass.
We have a new Pope now, Pope Francis.
Indeed.
He's taken a very significant name in terms of creation.
Yes.
And of, no doubt, flowers.
Yes,
as well.
Yes.
What flower do you think he would particularly appreciate?
Well, in this coat of arms, he has a very interesting flower, the Nardos, I understand it is in Spanish, the nard flower, to represent St. Joseph. It's a very sweet-smelling, very heavy perfume with the flower. It's a little white flower. I think in English it's called the tubular rose, and it's a very, very beautiful flower. I think one flower alone can fill the room with its scent. I was in Spain last year in September, and this particular flower is often used around the Feast of Our Lady of Sorrows on the September the 15th, and the children present this Nardos to Our Lady, and the smell in the churches was particularly beautiful. But this particular flower has been chosen by Pope Francis in his coat of arms to symbolise, with the other two designs of the coat of arms, the Holy Family. So he has the Jesuit coat of arms, the IHS for the Holy Name, Society of Jesus. Then he has the fleur-de-lis for Our Lady. And then the Nardos, a very little small flower, but highly perfumed, to represent St. Joseph. And so I presume he would perhaps take that flower as one of his own flowers, something small, something humble, to express perhaps his own personality and his way of doing things in this pontificate, but allowing the fragrance, a very strong fragrance, to permeate the atmosphere. And I think that is a beautiful flower to symbolise the pontificate of Pope Francis. Humble, small, but effective, and just one flower can make such a difference to a room with this perfume and its odour. And so perhaps Pope Francis is trying to remind us of humility and of our influence in the world, that we may be small as the church, and that we are able to influence by our own fragrance of following the Lord the other people, and to imbue the atmosphere with the Christian spirit and faith. In the Gospels, we hear of this particular flower, but in its perfume form, of the woman who comes to anoint the feet of our Lord. We believe that this woman may be Mary Magdalene, a well-known sinner in the area, and that she came and wiped the feet of our Lord and cried over the feet of our Lord. And we are told that she anointed the feet with a costly ointment, and then in the translation it says pure nard. And this nard is from the nardos flower, and we are told in the Gospel that the scent filled the whole room. It was a very expensive perfume, very expensive produce, and we are told that Judas Iscariot complained about the price of this ointment, and that he said that this could have been used for the poor. And again, this links very strongly with Pope Francis, because our Lord says, "You will have the poor with you always." And perhaps it is a timely reminder to us of our own commitment to the poor, and that the poor will be with us, as Christ himself has taught us, but that we must try to alleviate their poverty. And of course, it's something which Pope Francis himself is leading with our own particular lifestyles, with our simplicity and humility, and that we are, in fact, by serving the poor, we are serving Christ himself. Like Mary Magdalene, washing the feet of the Lord with our tears, washing those who are in need of that cleansing and that forgiveness and mercy of the Lord.
You were listening there to Father Jason Jones of the Diocese of Menevia in South Wales. Our thanks go to him. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, we won't be back again at this same time tomorrow, but we will be back again at the same time next weekend, so be sure to join us then. You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.